Last minute escapes. In the sun. What is the best airline? Oh, the worst airline. What happens if my flight is delayed or cancelled? Would I be put on a new flight? Or would I be refunded? What if it takes me days to get home? Benefits of a UK staycation.
When life gives you questions, get answers at which.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the Which Shorts podcast. I'm Rob Lilly Jones. Today we're celebrating a big anniversary, the 50th anniversary of Which Travel. Since 1974, we've been reviewing destinations, informing legislation, and fighting tirelessly to protect the rights of travellers across the globe. To mark the occasion, on this episode, we're returning to a destination we first visited in that first year, 50 years ago. Gran Canaria sits in the middle of the Canary Islands, and its year-round sun means it remains a hotspot for tourists. 3.8 million people visited the island in 2023, the second most visited Canary Island after Tenerife. Well, 50 years ago, Which visited the island, and now we've returned to see what's changed. Why does the island remain so popular with holidaymakers? Did the concrete development boom destroy the island? Or has it been able to rediscover a sense of identity and tranquility away from the high-rise resorts? I'll hand you over to Guy Hobbs to take you through his piece from our special anniversary edition.
With the sun poised on the peak of Roque Nublo and my chin resting on the edge of an infinity pool, I gaze into the valley some 1,500 metres below. Centuries of explosive eruptions have moulded the landscape into plunging gorges and narrow terraces, all draped in a crumpled blanket of lush green, while steady erosion has carved crowning peaks that glisten gold, then orange. These are Gran Canaria's sacred mountains, slap bang in the centre of the island, worshipped by early inhabitants, then hardy hikers, and now me, as I float in the warm spa waters of Tejeda's Parador Hotel. It's a moment of pure bliss. But it's also something of a surprise. Can this really be the same island we insisted that some people would hate in an issue of Holiday Which published 50 years ago? When we visited in 1974, the tourist industry was booming. The new international airport terminal had recently opened, and a decade of careless concrete construction had seen a string of new mass-market resorts rise from the desert of the south. We weren't impressed. It doesn't seem a good place for family holidays, we said, but it might appeal to those who just want fun at night and to rest by day. As I set off to retrace the steps of that early feature and find out what the island could offer a new generation of holidaymakers, I wasn't holding out much hope. But I'm instantly won over by Las Palmas. It's a thriving cosmopolitan capital with a colourful historic centre, a maze of cobbles, courtyards and carved wooden balconies, with the beautifully restored Canarian residence Casa de Colón, where Columbus supposedly stayed en route to the Americas, at its heart. Better still, Las Palmas has one of Europe's best city beaches, Playa de las Canteras, a 3 kilometre stretch of golden sand protected by a natural reef which offers safe swimming and superb snorkelling. My sunset stroll along the palm-lined promenade takes in market stalls and numerous beachfront bars, and the air is thick with evening chatter. To my surprise, not a word of it is in English. This is unexpected, not just because Playa de las Canteras was the original holiday playground of British tourists and our first stop in 1974, but because not so long ago, Las Palmas was an unofficial colony of the British Empire. In the 19th century, British businessmen got rich importing coal from UK collieries and sending their ships home brimming with bananas. It was this constant flow of Canarian fruit to London's dockyards that gave Canary Wharf its name. The British grew in numbers and influence, developing the port, building Spain's first golf club, and financing the island's first hotel, the elegant Santa Catalina, with its marble interior and fairy tale turrets providing a beacon for the British Empire. In 1908, the expat community even founded its own social club, housed in a bright red beachfront mansion. And when Witch visited in 1974, it was a highlight of the trip. Back then, a guinea a week gave tourists temporary access to bridge evenings, cocktail parties, and film screenings. They were showing Princess Anne's wedding when we visited. And to my astonishment, as I wander through the leafy, British-built suburb of the Ciudad Jardín, Garden City, some 50 years later, the British Club is still there. Tentatively, I ring the doorbell. "You seem awfully young," jokes Betty Burgess, the current club president, as she leads me through the members' bar with its framed letters from the Queen and huge portrait of Winston Churchill, for someone who visited 50 years ago. Betty's own association with the club goes back to 1967, when, in her early 20s and recently married to a Las Palmas local, she first visited with some neighbours. They said, "Come and meet Wing Commander this and Lieutenant Colonel that." Most of the members had relocated from former British colonies, you see. I looked around and thought, this is not for me at all. But when she returned in the 1990s, she found the club had evolved. The number of Brits living in the city or visiting had dropped off, and we'd had an influx of Spanish members. Nowadays, 80% of the club's members are locals, most of whom have some British connection. Not just a relic of the empire, the club acts as a centre for cultural exchange. But it's no longer a guinea a week, and cocktail parties are not part of our lifestyle anymore, Betty tells me. We have a thriving bar and restaurant, we host talks and quiz nights, and bridge and canasta are still very popular. And can holidaymakers still visit? Yes, absolutely, and they do, she says. But do get in touch first. This is the British Club, after all. If the southern beach towns had been enough of a draw to empty, lovely Las Palmas of British residents and tourists, then I had to go and see them for myself. The beach, stretching 6 kilometres from Playa del Ingles to the lighthouse at Maspalomas, is undeniably spectacular. But the purpose-built towns still wear the scars of overdevelopment. Busy, brash and downright ugly in places, they were built in a frenzy of construction, motivated solely by the desire to pack in the punters. I'd be inclined to agree with my 1970s counterpart that there's nothing here worth a special visit, were it not for Maspalomas Dunes, a 400-hectare expanse of spectacular shifting sands, like a miniature Sahara on sea. But even these nearly fell victim to developers. The first hotels, including the enormous Oasis where we stayed in 1974, were built on the edge of the dunes at La Charca Lagoon, a vital wetland for resident and migrating birds. Next came a shopping centre and golf course, altering wind patterns so that sand stopped drifting inland and began blowing out to sea. For decades, developers wreaked havoc on a rare and extremely fragile living ecosystem. Until finally, the tide turned in the late 80s, and the area was declared a protected nature reserve. I take the path leading from the Mirador de las Dunas at the Palace Hotel, and in a matter of minutes have disappeared among the dunes. Some soft and undulating, others sheer and angular. With 10-metre high rippling walls on either side, the roaring of the Atlantic reduces to a gentle purr and the hotels disappear. Deep in the dunes, it's easier to imagine Maspalomas before the concrete took over and how its development could have been so different. Luckily, you don't need to imagine. Postcard-pretty Puerto de Mogán is just 20 minutes further along the coast, but it feels like a different world. Nicknamed Little Venice for the series of sea-filled canals and arched bridges linking the marina to the town, it's regularly rated the best holiday resort in the Canary Islands by witch readers. On our first visit, Mogán would have been little more than a fishing village. Then, in 1982, land was reclaimed to create a soft crescent beach and a marina complex of whitewashed apartments, brightly outlined in primary colours and draped in every dazzling shade of bougainvillea. There's a sense that by the 1980s, the government had learned its lesson. Apart from the old fishermen's cottages clinging to the cliff face, the entire town is low-rise. Buildings taller than 2 stories are strictly forbidden, and an artificial reef has been built to help protect and regenerate the seabed. You can visit that project on an all-electric yellow submarine that takes you 20 metres under the sea. I couldn't resist. Clambering into the 18-metre-long hull, I admire the futuristic curves and shiny portholes before an eerie silence descends. The sub dives, and I'm suddenly transported into bedknobs and broomsticks. Stripy sea bream and iridescent king mackerel follow alongside, eyeing me suspiciously, and I half expect them to start singing before something spooks them and they dart into the depths. Back on land, I wander the flower-filled streets, swim off the sandy beach, and eat grilled red snapper at a restaurant overlooking the harbour. With Mogan, the developers finally got it right. But there's more to Gran Canaria than sun, sea and sand. Recent decades have seen a resurgence of interest in the island's pre-Hispanic past, something that barely registered on the tourist trail when we first visited. But we did make a passing reference to a cave painting in Galdar. Intrigued, I drove north to find it. The Cueva Pintada, painted cave, a 7th century dwelling adorned in neat geometric patterns thought to represent a lunar and solar calendar, didn't open to tourists until 1972, when which visited 2 years later, we would have seen the checkerboards, triangles and cosmic swirls in bright red, black and gold. But by 1982, the cave had to close. These are without a doubt the finest indigenous paintings anywhere in the islands, says Gemma, my guide at Galdar. But in the 1970s, we didn't know how to protect them. Then, 10 years of tourists crammed into the cave did some serious damage. Even the effect of breathing was enough to drastically reduce the colour of the pigments, she tells me. But it gets worse. Desperate to undo the damage, restorers tried a variety of methods to clean up the paintings, even spraying them with water. It was a disaster, Gemma says. So they locked the cave and walked away. It didn't reopen to the public until 2006. Thankfully, the story doesn't end there. In the 1980s, further excavations revealed that the cave was part of a huge settlement hewn into the soft volcanic rock over centuries. And when I visit in 2024, there's an audible gasp from my group as, following a short film, the screen rises to reveal the vast scope of the current excavations. At its centre is the cave. I gaze in awe at the ancient paintings, finally safe for generations to come, and Gemma leads me from a humidity-controlled glass bubble, locking the door securely behind us. From Galdar, I take the white-knuckle, ear-popping road into the island's jagged interior, where that sunset dip in the Parador's pool awaits. High in the sacred mountains, indigenous sites are still being unearthed at a pace. And in the village of Artanara, where locals still live in caves, a new visitor centre details hikes to hand-carved honeycomb chambers and ceremonial temples. In 1974, we warned that visitors to Gran Canaria might get bored. But as I pack for the airport, I'm struck by how much there still is to see. We'll have to come back, I think to myself. Let's just hope it doesn't take another 50 years.
Thank you to Guy for taking us through his piece, originally published for Witch Travel Special 50th Anniversary Edition. Remember, you can find more articles you'll find useful every day on everything from money and technology to home and garden advice by signing up to one of our many free email newsletters. And you can do that at witch.co.uk/newsletters. We'll be back next week for another episode of Witch Shorts, and thanks for listening. Witch Shorts was produced by me, Rob Lily Jones, edited by Adrian Bradley, while the exec producer was Grace Farrell.
...2023 was momentous in the fight against fraud. It saw the passing of the Online Safety Act and the Financial Services and Markets Act, both of these happening after years of exhaustive campaigning from us here at Witch. But the battle against scams is far from over. Stay in the know and avoid falling victim to scammers by joining over 450,000 others who have signed up to our Witch Scam Alerts. To sign up, head to witch.co.uk/scamalert today.